TED Audio Collective.
Welcome to the TED Interview. I'm your host, Stephen Johnson. Looking back on this season of the show, we've gone deep into the creative process of one of today's greatest novelists.
My conscious ideas are not good enough, frankly. They're not original. So I've got to get out from under those and get to something that surprises even me.
We've explored what understanding the deep cosmos tells us about the condition of our humanity.
We can't actually predict where these ideas are going to come from. And in some sense, the interesting scientific questions that come up through conflict.
And we've dreamed of a future world without pandemics.
If we start thinking differently about how we're monitoring the animal health, the environmental health, and other issues, we could start getting to predicting and preventing these outbreaks without any human disease. And that's when it gets really exciting.
But for our last episode of this season, we have something really special for you. One of the most original and influential artists of the past 50 years, David Byrne. David Byrne is probably best known for being a founding member of the Talking Heads, but he's had an equally full solo career, including collaborations with the likes of Brian Eno and St. Vincent. His work has been staged on Broadway with the show American Utopia, and he's scored film for features like The Last Emperor. He's written the terrific book, How Music Works, which we're going to talk about today quite a bit. One of his latest creations is an immersive theater experience in Denver called Theater of the Mind. David is the perfect guest to wrap up a season that has taken us to so many different domains, in part because he's someone who has really refused to settle into just one creative field. And he's truly one of the great collaborators in modern culture. That's next on the TED Interview.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
David Byrne, welcome to the TED Interview.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to do this.
I've been just rereading your book, How Music Works, and you tell a story about the early days of the Talking Heads in New York, where you talk about this kind of subtractive approach to coming up with the sound and the style and the presentation of the band. Just quoting from it, you say, it was a performance style defined by negatives. No show-offy solos, no rock moves or poses, no pomp and drama, no rock hair. It was mathematics. When you subtract all that unwanted stuff from something, art or music, what do you have left? And I thought that was just a fascinating way to think about creativity. Like, what can you remove to make something more interesting? Is that an approach that you've tried at other points in your career, or was it somehow uniquely suited to the early days of Talking Heads?
I'm sure I've tried it in other areas as well. The idea is that don't adopt any received or existing ways of doing something or ways of presenting something or executing something, because that won't necessarily be yours. Not that one has to completely reinvent the wheel all the time. I find it's often really good to strip something down and go, okay, let's start with the things that feel like the basic things that you can feel comfortable with. And it doesn't stay that way. With music, various things got added back in, but only when I discovered a way to do it that felt like it was integral and authentic to myself. There was a period where I didn't really move around much on stage. And then eventually, I found like, oh, there's ways of moving that feel integral to me that don't look like I'm just imitating some rock stars that I've seen before.
Staying with those early days of the Talking Heads at CBGB's and other venues in downtown Manhattan, when people saw this kind of stripped down performance style that was missing all of those ingredients. Was it confusing for those audiences? Were they like, well, where's the rock hair and where are the solos? Or was that world already so open to new ideas that they immediately, you know, found a place for it?
The downtown New York world was and is, well, what's left of it, a very small world. But yes, it was very accepting. And it was very accepting across the disciplines. You had a lot of artists coming to CBGBs to see various bands, and which was kind of interesting. And there were artists that we admired and we thought were kind of influential, or we admired them or thought highly of them. They were all very accepting of, like, here's somebody who's doing something that's a little bit different.
CBGBs is right at the beginning of how music works. You talk about the physical space of that room. I saw some shows there before they closed it down in the early 90s when I was first arrived in New York, and it was a really interesting space. And you have a wonderful riff about just how music is, in a way that kind of non-musicians may not realize, is often crafted for the kinds of rooms that it is being performed in. And you talk a little bit about how the early days of Talking Heads were shaped by the physical environment of CBGB. There's been this interesting architectural element that runs through your work. And now you have a new project that is very much about moving through physical space, Theater of the Mind. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Theater of the Mind project, which is running in Denver, it's an immersive theater project that's based on a lot of neuroscience experiments and perceptual phenomena. We started with those as a basis, and then eventually we added a story that takes you through from one experience to another. So there's a reason why you're going through. And the physical structure is, it's in a warehouse that's been divided into seven rooms, and an audience, a 16-member audience, goes into the first room. They're met by a guide, and that guide, an actor, takes them through all the rest of the rooms. And 15 minutes later, another group of 16 comes into the first room and is met by another actor. And that goes on all day. And the actor plays a person who is telling you about their life and things that happened to their life that they, maybe their perception of it or their memory of certain things is a little bit different than they thought they were. And so they take you back to those places in their life, the rooms where something happened, whether it was the family kitchen or the backyard or a disco where the person was a DJ. And you see how their perception of things is very malleable and not entirely accurate.
And is it based on your own life?
Yes and no. There's a couple of things that I borrowed from my own life to help with the story. The guide's name is David, and we use childhood picture of me as a childhood picture of the character. But other than that, I was never a DJ. The other bits of the story that happened, they're just completely made up. But of course, people tend to think that it's me being autobiographical, and it probably doesn't hurt if they think that.
And tell me about the neuroscience side of it. So how is that integrated into the project?
A lot of it is perceptual phenomena, how we perceive and scale the world, how we hear things. We don't all hear things the same. We don't see things the same. How we perceive things changes based on context. Attention, how we prioritize motion over static things. In fact, static things can just completely disappear from our view. They're just not there. All those sorts of things. They're not like cutting edge things, but when you put them all together, they add up to a way of kind of how we build our identity out of our memories of these events and how we perceive things. And you realize that our identities are therefore not entirely accurate either.
Yeah. So fascinating. Well, thinking about other kinds of theater experiences that you've been involved with. You know, you've just come off this incredible run with American Utopia. And I was watching the Spike Lee film version that you did over the weekend. And I think because I had just reread How Music Works, I was really paying attention to the choreography because you'd written about that a little bit in that book. And so there's a great story in How Music Works about this kind of emergent algorithmic dance choreography strategy that I think Naomi LaFrance introduced. And I was curious, like, you know, what was the process for coming up with the moves for American Utopia?
To begin with, for that tour and that Broadway show, we figured out a way to have all the musicians, every one of them, be completely wireless. Yeah. So no one was fixed on stage, not the drummers or the keyboard player, the people who are usually kind of stuck in one spot. They could all move around. That meant that the drumming had to be dispersed amongst six players because one person can't be carrying a drum kit. But it worked. So that meant, okay, now we have this completely stripped down, empty playing field for in which the musicians can act on, which is kind of a dream come true for a choreographer. You're now talking about not just some dancers dancing in front of the band or something like that, but everybody participates. So we worked with a choreographer, Annie B. Parson, and I've worked with her before. She is very good at teaching people kind of choreography that she has developed that is within their means to perform, but also working with non-dancers to turn their own movement into a kind of choreography. And that's what I'm used to doing that for years and years now, where I realize that this music or something makes me want to move this way. So you kind of formalize that, and okay, when that happens, then you should move that way. And so it's almost as if the music is telling you what way to move. And I find that works pretty well. You just have to take notes on it, either by videotape or some other means. To me, it worked really well.
Yeah, I would say so. And how would you describe your own movement style?
Well, it's a little bit stiff, maybe a little bit odd and maybe jerky, or I don't think I've ever tried to move like someone else. I've developed a kind of vocabulary of my own. It's not obviously sexy or anything like that in a kind of conventional way. I've worked something out that works for me.
It's hard to think of an artist over the last few decades who has had such a wide range of collaborations with such an eclectic mix of people. So it seems pretty clear from the outside, at least, that this is one of your gifts, right? You're an incredibly gifted songwriter and performer, but you also seem to have a talent as a collaborator. And I'm curious, you know, what goes into that skill?
I'm very curious how other people work, how they see things, and you collaborate with them. You kind of find that out. You find out what their creative process is and how they work. And so you kind of learn a little bit more about how to do things than the rut that you kind of tend to get into. I also find laying out the parameters for the collaboration is pretty important right off the bat. And you say, okay, I'm going to do this. I have my little area that I'm working in, whether it's like I'm writing the lyrics and singing and you're doing the music or something like that, or someone on co-writing the script to the theater of the mind. But then, as with all theater projects, the director has input. But the rules are very clear in the theater. Director cannot write the script. Only the writers can make the changes, but the director can make suggestions. It's a really smart way of drawing borders and making that really clear, because when it works, the director, let's say, can make suggestions, but they're not binding. And so the writer kind of feels a little bit of freedom to try those suggestions, but knowing that if they don't work, or if the writer doesn't like them, they can reject them and go back to the way it was. I sometimes enjoy working with other musicians, especially if they can tell me pretty clearly what it is they're after. You know, if people are really vague, it makes it very, very hard. But if they can, even a little bit, that really, really helps.
One of the things that you've written about, and it's been such an interesting part of your career, is the relationship between new technologies and the form and the content of music. There's some great chapters in How Music Works where you talk about that. And this was, in some cases, material that I was familiar with because I've written about that as well. But there were a number of things that I had not heard before that just blew me away. One of them is the way kind of club music in the 70s and early 80s was transformed by the introduction of these 12-inch vinyl singles because of the size of the groove, the actual physical groove on the records changed the kind of music that you could produce in those venues. Can you explain that history?
So a vinyl record has a groove etched into it by a thing called a cutting lathe. And there's a little needle that vibrates as it's cutting this groove into the record. And it's a groove. It's a spiral. It's a very, very long spiral that goes around and around and around and around until it gets to the middle of the record. And then when you put your player, your needle, down on it, it responds to those little vibrations or the little changes in the groove, and that needle vibrates, and then that's translated into the music that you hear. That's amplified and all that. So bass frequencies, lower frequencies, take up more of the vibration of the needle in the cutting and in the groove than do high frequencies. So, for example, when very early records and cylinders and things like that were recording jazz groups, the lower instruments like the bass drum and the tuba and things like that that were in those groups, basically they couldn't handle it. It would make the needle, the playback needle on your player, jump right out of the groove because it was a bigger change in the groove. So they would actually change the music. They would say, okay, you have to step to the back. We're going to make the bass drum and the bass quieter in this music than what it really is. But when DJs and others started coming up with these 12-inch mixes, what were called 12-inch mixes, they would take basically a single, maybe a slightly extended single, and play that over a disc the size of a whole LP, a 12-inch disc, which meant that the grooves could be wider and further apart, so the whole record could be louder, and the bass, the low end, the bass could be more prominent. So you got suddenly this club music where the bass was really kind of kicking, and the kick drum and all that, and that became much more of a thing. And then, of course, then when digital recordings came in, there was no limit to what you could do with the bass.
The other thing that I thought in terms of music technology that was so striking, and I'm sure somebody's written a whole book on this, but I never really thought about it, is how revolutionary cassettes were, audio cassettes. And this is a technology that's really gone. I mean, my kids do not know what a tape cassette looks like at all. And they know what a vinyl record looks like. But cassettes were a huge, you know, kind of icon of my childhood. But, you know, you describe a number of the things that cassettes made possible. They were really, in a sense, the kind of a glimpse of what was coming with digital music.
Well, very much so, yeah. Oh, cassettes were very tiny reel-to-reel tapes that you didn't have to fuss with. You just pop the thing in to the player and you're good to go. You don't have to like wind the tape around
right.
reels or anything like that. But what was really special about this and what really scared the record industry was that not only could you play music on the cassettes, you could record it yourself. And, you know, people came out with boom boxes and things, so you could record music off the radio, which I did. If I heard something I loved, I would just press record and go, what is that? And I would go out often and buy that record. It was actually helping us discover more music. But then you had people like me and many others making mixtapes. So what would now be called playlists.
Yeah.
The time was limited. I think you could get like 90 minutes on a cassette. You'd put the songs that kind of fit a particular mood, like a bunch of songs for dancing or songs for kind of late at night or songs that you would send to a special someone as a kind of message about this is what I love. I hope you like it too, that kind of thing.
And then it makes the Walkman possible too, right? So then you have that kind of personal, always on ambient kind of sound following you around because you've got this, you couldn't do that. You can carry around a vinyl record player.
And Sony came out with the Walkman, which was kind of the analog precursor to the iPod.
Yeah.
And so you had your own private music experience, something that people are really used to now. But then music was always a public thing. It was playing either on a boombox or over a stereo or in a car or whatever. It was always kind of broadcast in public. And now it became private, which is very different way of perceiving and kind of consuming music.
Mm. There's also a kind of a history here about the early days of sampling, which you were involved with in the collaboration with Brian Eno, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. I've always loved this story. I actually wrote about this story in one of my books where Eno kind of moves to New York and he's used to BBC radio, you know, Radio 1 and Radio 2. And he turns on the radio in New York and there's a crazy person like kind of ranting on the radio and he thinks, oh my gosh, this is very unusual. There's a crazy person ranting on the radio. I must record this voice. And then he lives there for a little longer and realizes that the radio is just filled with crazy people ranting in New York City. And so some of those kind of that found audio that you both collected in that period becomes kind of interlaced into that record, which is, you know, one of the points of origin for sampling. What I didn't know was that those, that kind of preacher style that is in a lot of those, in a lot of that record, influenced your own vocals on Once in a Lifetime.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would listen to some of the radio preachers who were ranting. The good ones are very musical. It's like a kind of poetry that really is in some space between kind of text and music. Their voice is very repetitive. It has a cadence. It's very musical. So I realized that if I could imagine myself as a preacher and just in my loft, in the Lower East Side, and start ranting on my own and pretending, kind of acting that out, where would that go? So I started doing that and then kind of writing down all the phrases that came to me. And then, yeah, that became the verses of that song.
I did a conversation years ago with Eno where he talked about this practice, and maybe he originated with you in the studio with the Talking Heads, I don't know, but in his later kind of career as a producer with U2 or Coldplay or whatever, when the band comes into the studio and they've just come off their tour and they've been playing the same songs over and over again, he does this routine where he has them all play different instruments, where he's like, okay, Bono, you're playing the drums now, and, you know, The Edge, you're playing the keyboards, whatever. His argument about it is that they sound much worse in an empirical way. They, you know, Bono is not a good drummer or whatever it happens to be, but there's something about that experience of playing an instrument that you're not a virtuoso at that kind of liberates the band to make a new sound. And I always thought that was a great kind of lesson. Like, even if you are an incredible guitarist, like, carve out time to play the drums badly just to explore the kind of possibility space in the studio. Is that something that you've done?
Yeah, we are. We've done that. We've done it with Eno and with other people as well. Obviously, you don't actually want something to sound bad. So if the drumming is really bad, that's sort of not going to work so well. But what you can sometimes do is, like, if I move over and play a keyboard part, I'll try and come up with a keyboard part that's within my abilities, that I can do. It might be a very limited and simple part, but it'll be, but I can play that well. Same things with, say, a keyboard player who picks up guitar. They can probably figure out how to play something relatively simple. And yeah, the good thing is sometimes you'll come up with things that a keyboard player or a guitar player would not come up with by themselves. Yeah.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Are there any new technologies in the studio and in the music world right now that you're particularly interested in? New electronic instruments, new recording techniques, anything that is potentially as interesting as those early synthesizers or the cassette tape?
Oh, there's all sorts of things, sort of programs and software and things that come out. I haven't used them, but there's kind of these vocal eliminator kinds of algorithms or software that will strip a voice off of a song, which allows someone who wants to be sampling the song to kind of grab a piece of the music without having the voice in. And there's other ones where they can take an instrument that's already recorded and change the chord structure of it. I mean, those things are, yeah, to me, are just amazing. The first one allows people to sample music that they wouldn't otherwise be able to sample. But it's not like there's been a shortage of things to sample. It'll just kind of open that up even further. I mean, I use the kind of computer to record a lot of things, but I find that my initial writing takes place just with kind of pen and pencil and an instrument. It often starts that way because the software tends to lead you to make music that is easy to make with that software.
Right. That's interesting.
No surprise. So if it makes everything in a 4-4 rhythm that is very repetitive, well, that's kind of where you're led. And if you want to do something a little bit outside of the box or a little bit different than that, that's a little bit more work. So you might not do it. But if you kind of do that ahead of time, and know that that's what you want to do, then you've kind of escaped the software trap.
Yeah, you had a great point about that in the book about the kind of the tyranny of the click track. That, you know, it really does, if you're working with digital audio tools, it really is a lot easier if it is recorded to a very rigorous like click track where it's a certain number of beats per minute, and that way you can cut and move things around really easily. But it's... you're then locked into this very mechanical rhythm that you can change the music that you make.
Yes, it does. And you can hear it in older recordings that didn't have click tracks. The band will kind of speed up. The group will kind of speed up, or they'll slow down just before a change happens or something like that. It's almost imperceptible, but it has kind of that has an emotional effect.
David, do you find that these new technologies, as they come about, are they changing your actual creative process?
They must be. All I can say is that they must be. That we, even without realizing it, I think we respond to the context around us, whether it be economic or technological or architectural or social or whatever it is. Yes, if the technology of music distribution is different, I can't help but think that people slowly and incrementally start making different kinds of music that at least they hope works better in that format on that platform. I know with streaming, I don't think so much now, but there was a period where artists were making records with like 30 tracks on, because that would get them more kind of streaming points. They were kind of trying to game the algorithm. And I think eventually, you know, the streaming platform said, no, we're not going to let you get away with this. But, okay. There is also, at least on streaming, a lot of artists have said that, and listeners have said that the song really has to grab your attention within the first 15 seconds. Otherwise, it's just easy. You just skip to the next one, which you wouldn't do if you put on a record or some other kind of thing. It would be a little bit of extra effort to move to the next song. So you have people writing songs that kind of intentionally try to put the hook and the most kind of catchy part right at the beginning.
A lot of Pink Floyd songs would not have done well that environment.
Exactly, yeah.
What is your general sense of the overall music ecosystem right now, which is, you know, shaped by technology and by digital distribution and streaming and all that stuff? Do you feel like we are at a particularly healthy point in terms of musical careers and the creation of music? Was there a golden age that we've left behind?
It seems to me that now there's just as much creativity as ever. There's an incredible amount of interesting and creative music being made by artists all over the world. That's really exciting. But at the same time, I think in some ways it's harder for kind of emerging musicians to get noticed, partly because there's so many of them now. It's easier to record music than it was before, so there's just a lot of it. Yeah, the field is very crowded. And unless you're kind of the handful of really, really successful artists, it's pretty hard to make a living doing it. I think it's harder to make a living doing it than it was before. That said, musicians can be pretty creative about how they do that too.
Yeah, it seems like it's, unless you really want to play live shows all the time, it's harder to make a living as a musician just releasing albums and not being on the road constantly.
I would say so, yes. It's hard to make a living doing that. Unless you become really successful, or you're writing songs for pop artists or all these other things, or, you know, writing songs for commercials or scores for TV or whatever it might be. But just kind of doing your own music and recording it and releasing it, streaming and all that doesn't pay that well. So it's pretty hard.
Yeah. I can't remember if it was some producer, I think maybe it was Steve Albini or something like that, was writing about how the one thing we forget is how hard it was to get to the point where you could release an album and get it distributed widely in 1970 or 1975.
Exactly.
So, there were so many great bands that literally never recorded an album because it was just too complicated to do that.
Exactly. And you needed funding, usually from a record company, to record an album. Now you don't. You can record it on your laptop, and it can sound just as good as a record that was recorded in a, you know, expensive studio back in the day. So that, on the face of it, sounds really good. So you have this glut of really professional sounding songs and music and recordings out there. But then the question is, how do they get noticed? Yeah.
Two last questions for you on slightly different topics. One of which is about bicycles. I feel like it has become over the years a kind of a ritual of becoming a New Yorker. You know you're a New Yorker when you've finally had the opportunity to spot David Byrne riding a bike around Lower Manhattan somewhere like that. It's just, you've been a big advocate for biking and particularly in urban spaces. We're going through a bit of a renaissance with that right now. I'd love to hear you describe why that is such an important part of urban life for you.
Wow. I've been using a bike as my principal means of transportation in New York for a long time now. I found that it was incredibly efficient. Unless you were going long distances, it was really efficient. You had to be really careful and aware of traffic. Less so now. Now there are more bike lanes.
Yeah.
It's a little bit safer. You still have to watch out for car doors or people making turns and pedestrians walking in front of you and all the various things. But now at least there's bike lanes that didn't exist in the past. So I find, not only is it efficient, To me, it just feels good. The feeling of kind of being self-guided, kind of in control of where I want to go and how I want to get there. And I can, for example, I had like a doctor's appointment on the Upper East Side. I live in Chelsea, so it's, I don't know, maybe 40 blocks or something and across town. And I know that on my bike, I know exactly how long it'll take me to get there. I couldn't ride a bike that day, and so I had to take a cab. And the cab took like half again as long as going on a bike, just because Midtown traffic is horrible, horrible. That might not be true in every city. But I recently, for Theater of the Mind, I spent a lot of time in Denver. Denver has good bike lanes, and Denver itself is pretty flat, so it's pretty easy to get around there. I recently got an electric bike, which I don't use all the time. But if I'm going to somewhere kind of far in Brooklyn, and I live in Manhattan, or in Queens or someplace like that, I'll use the electric bike. And that makes it less daunting and more likely that I will say, oh, yeah, going over the bridge is no big deal. So it just expands the radius of how far I can go.
Last question for you is about another project. In addition to the Broadway shows and the albums and the movies, you started a website, kind of a news service on some level, called Reasons to be Cheerful. A number of years ago, and it's going strong. You actually just announced a new kind of subscription program, which you can talk about. But what's the origin story of that? And tell us what you're up to with that in this latest iteration.
Wow. I sort of started doing it for myself. It was before Trump got elected, way before the pandemic. But I discovered that I'd wake up in the morning and look at the news and get angry or depressed or frustrated, as probably a lot of us do. And I thought, okay, I need an antidote to this. This is not good for my health. It's not good for my attitude towards the rest of the world, etc. So I started saving news articles about people who'd found solutions to things. First, I just started doing it myself and writing about these things myself. And then a few years ago, kind of made it official and hired writers and editors and web designers and, you know, the whole thing. So now there's a new article researched and discovered by our various writers every weekday. There's a new story. So it's incredible that there's that many stories that are kind of positive. Our brains are biased towards negative stories. So it's a little bit of an uphill battle to get people to read about positive stuff or solutions. But it's kind of working.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like the least interesting thing to people innately and in terms of the news media are stories of incremental progress. You know, people like to hear stories of gradual decline and terrible calamities or massive breakthroughs.
Yeah, but like cure for cancer or something like that. But when you
that'll
just go,
make the front page.
Yeah, we just go, this country or this town has found a way to, whatever, be energy sustainable in a way that other places could emulate if they chose to do so. Those are kind of, incremental stories, but they're kind of really important. Yeah. We're inviting people to become subscribers to help support us because we don't take ads. And we'll see how that goes.
Thank you for sharing these stories and these insights with us today. It's such a treat for us. That's it for the show today and for this season. The TED interview is part of the TED Audio Collective. This episode was produced by our managing producer, Wilson Sayre, and mixed by Erica Wong. Jimmy Gutierrez and Ben Ban Chang are our story editors. Fact-checking by Hana Matsudaira. Faraday Grunge is our project manager, and Dan O'Donnell is our executive producer. Special thanks to Constanza Giardo, Michelle Quint, Anna Phelan, and Rithu Jagannath. Additional thanks this season to Sammy Case, Roxanne Highlash, Colin Helms, Julia Dickerson, Daniela Balarezo, Valentina Bohanini, Jeff Dale, Nicole Idine, Will Hennessy, Marie Kim, Antonia Lee, Annie O'Dell, and Julia Ross. I'm your host, Stephen Johnson. For more info on my other projects, including my latest book, Extra Life, which is coming out any day now in a kids version, you can follow me on Twitter @StephenBJohnson or sign up for my Substack newsletter, Adjacent Possible.